Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 and goes out every Friday afternoon at 2 p.m. on BCFM 93.2. This week, China and the Royal Baby. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square. Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch helpline, aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number's 01454 318 753. And we'll have a reminder of the phone numbers for both Volunteering Bristol and Bully Watch at the end of the show. This November 2013 is the 50th anniversary of one of the most momentous events in post-war history, the assassination of US President John F. Kennedy. And if anyone tells you the Warren Commission decided the case will never be solved, don't believe them. Many believe that those responsible were so ruthless and embedded in the US military-industrial complex that the assassination was carried out by the mob and approved by the director of the CIA himself, Alan Dulles. The only prosecutions ever brought were by New Orleans' fearless district attorney, James Garrison, who wrote his own book, On the Trail of the Assassins. But we'll be hearing direct from Jim himself and others in a 1988 interview, where not only was his prosecution completed, but as a result of many other witnesses, it subsequently came forward to add to the picture. So over the next few weeks, as part of Dialect's summer schedule, we'll be taking you back 25 years to the Garrison interview and the full 50 years to 1963 and the voice of murdered suspect Lee Harvey Oswald being interviewed in his role as a spokesperson for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. We'll also hear from John Davis, who's author of Mafia Kingfish, Carlos Marcello and the Assassination of John F. Kennedy, and also filmmaker Oliver Stone. The original 1988 programme is narrated by Roscoe Mercer. It was produced, written and edited by David Mendelsohn and Andrew Phillips. The 1993 presentation was produced for Guns and Butter on KPFA Radio, part of the Pacifica Network, by Bonnie Faulkner and Yara Marso. This week, part one of three.
88.1 KFCF in Fresno and online at kpfa.org. Stay tuned for Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
And any time you hear anybody say that John Kennedy, like Lyndon Johnson, had something to do with our getting involved in the war in Vietnam, you are listening to a man who doesn't know what he's talking about.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, the assassination of JFK, the Garrison interview, part one. In this 1988 radio documentary, you will hear the voices of the narrator, Roscoe, co-producer and writer David Mendelsohn, interviewing former New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison, filmmaker Oliver Stone, Lee Harvey Oswald in a 1963 radio interview, and professor and author Philip Melanson. The assassination of JFK, the Garrison interview, was co-produced, edited, and directed by Andrew Phillips.
And an old soldier, Dwight Eisenhower, whose warning in the closing moments of his 8 years in the White House would be remembered by many as the prophetic speech of his career.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
This is a story about America. America, which proclaims that democracy means a government of, by, and for the people. America, which condemns foreign governments run by military dictatorships, societies ruled by the powerful few, who alone are party to decisions which affect the many. Where the process of leadership goes on behind closed doors, and presidents come and go without the people even knowing why. This is a story about that moment in America when the government changed and the people were excluded, not just from choosing their leader, but from knowing why their leadership changed. This is a story about that day in Dallas, the day John Kennedy died.
It appears as though something has happened in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route.
Put me on, Phil. Put me on. We understand there has been a shooting. The presidential car coming up now. We know it's the presidential car. You see Mrs. Kennedy's pink suit. There's a Secret Service man, spread eagle, over the top of the car.
For some time they were saying Castro killed Kennedy, and I think the current vogue now for the agency is to publish books saying the mob and all these ridiculous things, when any thinking person can look at the facts and see clearly that the main conflict was between Jack Kennedy and the Central Intelligence Agency. In fact, and it was on the front page of the New York Times in 1963, the split between the two of them. It came to a point where Jack Kennedy said, I'm going to tear the agency in 1,000 pieces. It just happened the agency tore him before he got a chance.
The Dallas police radio tape, on which 4 rifle shots in the correct time sequence have been superimposed.
That bringing out the truth is so critical that these words must be said. The American people have to face the fact that this is not an oversight, not a mistake on somebody's part. Every day that passes, high individuals at the very top of the United States government are playing an active role in concealing from you the truth of John Kennedy's murder.
Secret Service men standing up in the limousine. They are armed with submachine guns. It appears as though someone in the limousine might have been hit by the gunfire.
There's a lot of money to be made and has been made in keeping the Cold War going. And so there are a lot of, there are billions.
Just billions, that's all. Keeping the Cold War going means many billions coming in, and that's one of the reasons they killed Jack Kennedy to keep it going.
There are many unanswered questions concerning the death of President Kennedy, and there are several credible theories. In this program, we will present Judge Garrison's memories, views, and supporting evidence concerning his investigation. This is not a definitive examination of the tragic events of 1963, but the Garrison interview is an important audio document of a crucial and little understood moment of American history. Millions of Americans have seen Oliver Stone's movie, JFK, which focuses on Garrison's investigation in 1967. But very few have heard Judge Garrison recount his work and his message for America in his own words. In 1988, Sheridan Square Press, a division of the Center for Media Analysis, which published Garrison's memoir, On the Trail of the Assassins, described the book this way. 25 years ago, on November 22, 1963, President John F. Kennedy was murdered in Dallas, Texas. Within hours, it was learned that Lee Harvey Oswald, who was arrested for the crime, had lived in New Orleans the preceding summer. New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison immediately commenced an investigation and arrested a suspicious former CIA pilot and anti-Castro soldier of fortune named David Ferry. He turned Ferry over to the FBI for questioning, but shortly thereafter, federal authorities released him. 10 months later, the Warren Commission report ratified the official story that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin of the president. It was not until 3 years later that Jim Garrison returned to the investigation, after his friend Senator Russell Long confided to him his suspicion that the Warren Commission was dead wrong. Thus commenced an intensive and tortuous inquiry filled with bizarre characters that resulted in the only criminal prosecution ever brought for the murder of President Kennedy. As this harrowing tale reveals, Garrison painstakingly uncovered evidence, ignored by the Warren Commission, that members of the U.S. intelligence community had conspired to kill President Kennedy and that Lee Harvey Oswald had been set up as their fall guy. Among the key conspirators were Ferry, fanatical former FBI agent Guy Bannister, who was deeply involved with Cuban exiled mercenaries, and a distinguished pillar of New Orleans society, Clay Shaw, the director of the International Trade Mart. As Garrison built his case, crucial witnesses, including David Ferry, died mysteriously. Documents disappeared. The DA's office was repeatedly infiltrated. And, most intriguing of all, the federal government not only withheld its cooperation, but attacked the investigation. The media waged an intensive campaign vilifying Garrison, aimed at discrediting his case against Clay Shaw and corroborating the official story. Now, two decades after the Shaw trial, Jim Garrison finally tells his own story. He pieces together his thesis that President Kennedy was the victim of a conspiracy and cover-up involving elements of the CIA, the FBI, and state and local officials, all of them hell-bent on reversing the president's bold moves to lessen the tensions of the Cold War.
Every major move he made, and I'm saying move, not words, on this day he was sworn in, which are written for him by members of the staff. I mean, every major decision he made as president was toward ending the Cold War. So if you hear anybody describe him with a straight face as a Cold War, you're talking to somebody who doesn't know what he's talking about. Kennedy did so much and made so much progress towards ending the Cold War that those Cold Warriors who were in our government had to kill him in order to keep the Cold War going.
What changes in policy can you point to that occurred after his assassination, where we might see a turnabout from earlier Kennedy policies to the new Johnson policies?
There were a series of them, but the most immediate one occurred within 72 hours after his assassination. His successor, Lyndon Johnson, who was a closet Cold Warrior all the time, and who in the Senate was known as the Senator from the Pentagon because of his war-oriented philosophy, within 72 hours of John Kennedy's death, right after the eulogy in the rotunda, Lyndon Johnson crossed over to the old office building and met with the ambassador to South Vietnam, Henry Lodge, and said, in effect, you can go back and tell the Vietnamese now that we're going to back them all the way. In other words, what he was doing within 72 hours, no position papers, no 6 weeks, 2 months studies by the military and intelligence, within a few days, he was meeting with Lodge and telling him, we are changing the policy in the Far East 180 degrees. He reversed Kennedy's policy, and sure enough, in 18 months, he was pouring 500,000 American soldiers in there, an expeditionary force, with no reason. We were not even invited by South. We weren't wanted by South Vietnam. And of course, the result, as you know, was not only did we lose 55,000 fine young men, died, murdered by our own government, in a sense, but we got in a war which was not supported by the people, but was kept alive nevertheless by successively by Johnson and then by Nixon, to the point where in riots in Washington, D.C., they had to arrest 20,000 American citizens protesting the war. By those Nazi methods, they managed to make a war nobody wanted last 9 years. But with Kennedy, we would not have had the war because he said most specifically on the 2nd of October, 1963, he told Kenny O'Donnell, and it's in Kenny O'Donnell's book, Johnny, We Hardly Knew You, we're getting out of Vietnam. We will be completely out by 1965. That means the helicopters and everything. And incidentally, when he said that, we did not have a single combat soldier in Vietnam. As long as Jack Kennedy was alive, we did not have a single combat soldier in Vietnam. And any time you hear anybody say that John Kennedy, like Lyndon Johnson, had something to do with our getting involved in the war in Vietnam, you are listening to a man who doesn't know what he's talking about.
What is the evidence supporting the theory that JFK would not have carried out the Johnson-Vietnam policy of full-scale war, which led to 550,000 American ground troops and daily B-52 bombing runs, in the end dropping twice as much explosive force on that small country as was dropped by both sides in all of World War II. Arthur Schlesinger Jr., writing in the January 10, 1992 edition of the Wall Street Journal, No one can say what President Kennedy might eventually have done about Vietnam, but there is strong documentary evidence as to his long-run purpose. From the beginning to end of his administration, he steadily opposed repeated military recommendations that he introduce an American expeditionary force. Having watched the French army fail in Vietnam in 1951, he had no desire to send the American army into the same quagmire. The last thing he wanted, said General Maxwell Taylor, was to put in our ground forces. In the hope of enabling the South Vietnamese to save themselves, President Kennedy did agree to modest increases in the number of U.S. military advisers assigned to the South Vietnamese army. But as Roswell Gilpatrick, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, said later, resistance was encountered from the president at every stage as the total amount of U.S. personnel deployment increased. In July 1962, President Kennedy instructed Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, to start planning for the phased withdrawal of the American advisers. The target date for complete disengagement was the end of 1965. The military produced an acceptable plan in May 1963. Mr. Gilpatrick later said, McNamara indicated to me that this was part of a plan the president asked him to develop to unwind the whole thing.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the National Press Club. Here, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome in his second appearance at the National Press Club, Oliver Stone.
The central historical question raised by JFK, of course, has to do not with the tramps in Dealey Plaza, not with who might have been firing from the grassy knoll, not with what coalition of Cubans, exiles, mobsters, rogue intelligence officers the conspiracy might have been concocted by, but the darker stain on the American ground in the 60s and 70s, Vietnam. It is Vietnam which has become the bloody shirt of American politics, replacing slavery of 100 years before. Just as we did not resolve, if we ever did, the great battle over slavery until 100 years after the Civil War, when we passed the Voting Rights Act of 1965, so it becomes clear that the Vietnam War remains the watershed of our time. And the divisions in our country among our people opened up by it seemed to gape wider and wider with each passing year. JFK suggests it was Vietnam that led to the assassination of John Kennedy, that he became too dangerous, too strong an advocate of changing the course of the Cold War, too clear a proponent of troop withdrawal for those who supported the idea of a war in Vietnam and later came to support the war itself. Was President Kennedy withdrawing from Vietnam? Had he indicated strongly his intention to do so? Had he committed himself firmly and against all hawkish advice to the contrary to oppose the entry of U.S. combat troops? The answer to these questions is unequivocally yes. As Arthur Schlesinger Jr. has attested, and Major John Newman, a young historian here on this dais who has devoted himself to a 10-year study of this, can attest. His book, JFK in Vietnam, a major work, will surely contribute more heavily than any other volume of immediate military history to the solution of these questions. Major Newman makes it very clear, President Kennedy signaled his intention to withdraw from Vietnam in a variety of ways and put it firmly on the record with the National Security Action Memorandum 263 in October of 1963. Those who try to say it was no more than a call for a rotation of troops or a gimmick or and that the Johnson NSAM 273 within a week of the assassination merely confirmed the policy, ignore the obvious question. If LBJ was merely continuing Kennedy's policies, why was it necessary to reverse the NSAM?
The first order he gave in that regard was to return 1,000 of our troops as a gesture that could not be misunderstood, 1,000 troops by the end of December 1963, but that was countermanded within 24 hours of his death, which gives you some idea of how much backing he had from his own government.
Let's look at his Cuba policy. Bay of Pigs would certainly seem like it was an anti-communist move.
The Bay of Pigs was not his. policy. The Bay of Pigs was inherited from the previous administration. And the main designer and supervisor of the Bay of Pigs was a man named Richard Nixon, who later, when he got back in office, helped to keep the Vietnam War going. He was one of the Cold Warriors, a dedicated Cold Warrior from the first time he entered public office. But that was not Kennedy's policy. Kennedy inherited that, and his position, and he left no doubt about it, was I don't have much alternative. People think that I'm failing to follow up on the previous president if I don't go ahead with something that he's initiated. But he was not very enthusiastic about it. He was most reluctant. And the invasion of the Bay of Pigs of Cuba, as you know, was being accomplished by anti-Castro Cubans, trained and backed, of course, by American advisors, by the CIA project. But it was insufficiently backed, and this agency thought that it could jam Jack Kennedy into bringing in the Navy fighter planes, which were just over the horizon on the Navy flat tops. Their engines were even warmed up, so they were obviously intended to be used. But Kennedy didn't intend to bring us into World War III that casually. And so when the man in charge of the Bay of Pigs, General Cabell, Charles Cabell, who just by strange coincidence happened to be the brother of Mayor Earl Cabell, in whose town Jack Kennedy was murdered a year or two later, when General Charles Cabell called on President Kennedy to make the Navy planes available, John Kennedy said, absolutely not, and returned him down. So that was not really John Kennedy's project at all. Then the Cuban Missile Crisis, when that was laid on John Kennedy, he recognized it for the crisis it was, for the possible beginning of World War III. But it's important to see that in its perspective. It's becoming increasingly apparent, I think, to most thinking Americans, and I certainly have no brief for the Russians, because I happen to be on the American side and served most of my adult life in the service. But it's becoming increasingly apparent to most Americans that the reason the Russians put the missiles in there was they wanted to discourage any further American adventurism or landing in Cuba. And in any case, whichever view you take, the crisis was laid upon us by those missiles. And Kennedy's view, certainly the right view, was we had to get those missiles out of there. But the approach recommended to him by the military and our intelligence advisors around Kennedy was to bomb and invade Cuba. A desire, much desired, of course, by the military and intelligence. But Kennedy replied, as only Kennedy could, wouldn't that kill an awful lot of Cubans? And so he found the solution that they didn't dream of, because you can't deny his intelligence nor his imagination. And his solution, which he was able to work out, communicating through the Russian ambassador and with Khrushchev of Russia, they worked out a solution in which Kennedy's solution was the blockade. Without firing shots, without bombing Cuba, without killing Cuba, we simply set up a blockade. And at first, reluctantly, and then finally, realizing that was the best solution, the Russians ended up pulling out their missiles. And that was what I think can fairly be described as a resolution of the Cuban crisis without drawing the United States into a war. At the same time, it was not a Cold War move. It was an anti-Cold War move, because it used reason rather than force to resolve the problem. The reaction of the Cubans and the anti-Castro individuals who were being trained, they were being trained north of Lake Pontchartrain in New Orleans. Guy Bannister, former special agent in charge of the Chicago office, by 1962 and 63 was working for the Central Intelligence Agency. And his right-hand man was David Ferry, who comes into the story later. But Guy Bannister was operating this anti-Castro movement, which was completely in opposition to everything that Kennedy was talking about and had in mind. It contemplated nothing less, ultimately, than another invasion of Cuba. The Cubans themselves had come, and the anti-Castro adventurers with them, had come to hate John Kennedy for what they regarded as a failure to back them up. But actually, it was quite different. It was a case of avoiding a war on his part when he agreed with Khrushchev not to invade Cuba again. But they never forgave him for that. And nevertheless, even worse, they were continuing to violate the president's specific order, which is the law of the land, and they were training daily for the ultimate invasion of Cuba. They had a cover name, which they kept secret, but it's kind of surfaced in some recent years. It's called Operation Mongoose. And it looked like, on the surface, like a legitimate a series of forays against Cuba, ostensibly in the national interest. But if you look at the actual description in a 1961 memorandum of Operation Mongoose, as described by Major General Lansdale, who'd spent years in Vietnam, keeping the Vietnam War going, you will see that it was clear that he had in mind once more the ultimate invasion of Cuba and nothing less. And so what you had under the cover of Operation Mongoose, you had this daily training going north of the Lake Pontchartrain. That's how New Orleans comes into it. I didn't put New Orleans into it. Sometimes people say, why you, as if I brought New Orleans into it? And the answer, of course, if I was D.A. of Pittsburgh, it wouldn't have been me. But I was D.A. of New Orleans, and New Orleans is where they were setting up this next invasion of Cuba. And every day or so, Dave Ferry would drive from dressed in army combat outfits, black boots, and he'd drive from Bannister's office across the lake and check the training, which consisted largely of shooting, come back and give his report, and it was moving forward pretty steadily until Kennedy learned in late 63, precisely August the 1st, 1963, he learned now that for several years now, his orders against any more anti-Cuba activity, much less preparation for a new land invasion of Cuba, was being violated. So he had to call on the FBI to actually raid the CIA camp where the Cubans and other anti-Castro people were being trained. But even then, the FBI, because the intelligence community protects different parts of each other, did not make it public to the people until we were able to find it out. The troops were being trained there, too, to land in Cuba. But they broke it up for the time being. I'm not sure that made a lot of difference by then. A lot of men had been trained since this was August 1st, 63, an awful lot of men had been trained and were available to do some shooting when November came in Dallas.
You're listening to Dialect on BCFM 93.2. And this is California-based community radio show Guns and Butter's presentation of a 1988 Pacifica Radio documentary, The Assassination of JFK, The Garrison Interview. This November marks 50 years since the 1963 assassination of the last US president to rein back rather than expand US military intervention around the world. And New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison conducted the only judicial prosecution into JFK's assassination. You can find this full program online at www.gunsandbutter.org and on dialectradio.co.uk.
This reminds me a little of some of the Iran-Contra activities that certain elements of intelligence through NSC seemed to be carrying on, a foreign policy that was separate, at least from the espoused policy of the executive branch and certainly the foreign policy of the Congress. But in this case, the president acted through the FBI to break up this secret team's activities.
It's not just a little, that's a very good analogy, a metaphor, but it's not just a little, like, it really is the predecessor to it. In other words, the CIA was, in the Kennedy thing, was not using just CIA individuals, it was going off the shelf, which is his phrase, going outside of the agency offices, so forth, and going to taking some civilian groups and other groups off the shelf operation that was building up by 63, which I just described. The force from which you had the central ingredients that actually murdered John Kennedy, which, leaves it nothing but a CIA murder of John Kennedy, with the covert elements of the CIA. That's what I want to emphasize. But that was indeed the predecessor of the Iran-Contra business. It was the grandfather of that and the others which followed. I think Casey had in mind setting up a series of off-the-shelf operations, and it probably wasn't the first one the North was involved in.
Friday, November 22nd, 1963. The first day begins at an early morning breakfast meeting. President Kennedy greets an overflow audience.
2 years ago, I said that, introduced myself in Paris by saying that I was the man who had accompanied Mrs. Kennedy to Paris. I'm getting that same sensation as I travel around Texas. Nobody wonders what Lyndon and I wear.
A short flight to Love Field at Dallas. Arrival time, 11:37 of the same morning.
It looks like a police convention. We have never seen as many Dallas police officers in one location in all of our years of covering Dallas news, but they are here in great profusion. The security precautions at this luncheon they're going to attend range from the distance from the president's car door to the trademark entrance and to how many doors and windows are in the building, and even the method of selecting the steak the president will eat. And here is the presidential jet, U.S. Air Force number one, printed on the side. And the crowd begins its cheer, which you can't hear over the whistle and hum of the jet. But handkerchiefs are being waved, the placards are being held high, and hundreds of tiny American flags are now being waved toward the presidential jet. The doors fly open, and the loading ladders are being wheeled into place. This is a split-second timed operation for the Secret Service and the Air Force and the Signal Corps. Nothing's left to chance. Every possible precaution has been taken.
You're listening to The Assassination of JFK, The Garrison Interview, Part 1. This 1988 radio documentary was co-produced by David Mendelsohn and Andrew Phillips and includes the voices of narrator Roscoe, former New Orleans DA Jim Garrison, filmmaker Oliver Stone, Lee Harvey Oswald, and Philip Melanson. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
This is the first of a series of Latin listening post interviews with persons more or less directly concerned with the conflict between the United States and Cuba. In subsequent programs, we will present talks with people who are connected with the Cuban refugee organizations, people who are connected with President Batista, and U.S. citizens with direct stakes in the outcome of the Cuban situation. Tonight, we have with us a representative of probably the most controversial organization connected with Cuba in this country. The organization, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. The person, Lee Oswald, secretary of the New Orleans chapter to the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. This organization has long been on the Justice Department's blacklist and is a group which is generally considered to be the leading pro-Castro body in the nation. As a reporter of Latin American affairs in this city for several years now, your columnist has kept a lookout for local representatives of this pro-Castro group. None appeared in public view until this week, when young Lee Oswald was arrested and convicted for disturbing the peace. He was arrested while passing out pro-Castro literature to a crowd which included several violently anti-Castro Cuban refugees. When we finally tracked Mr. Oswald down today and asked him to participate in Latin listening posts, he told us frankly that he would because it may help his organization attract more members in this area. With that in mind, and knowing that Mr. Oswald must have had to demonstrate a great skill in dialectics before he was entrusted with his present post, we now proceed on a course of random questioning of Mr. Oswald. Mr. Oswald, if I may, how long has the Fair Play for Cuba Committee had an organization in New Orleans?
We have had members in this area for several months now. Up until about 2 months ago, however, we have not organized our members into any sort of an active group. Until, as you say, this week, we have decided to feel out the public what they think of our organization, our aims. And for that purpose, we have been, as you say, distributing literature on the street for the purpose of trying to attract new members and feel out the public.
Are you at liberty to reveal the membership of your organization?
No, I'm not.
For what reason?
Well, as secretary, I believe it's standard operating procedure that an organization consisting of a political minority protect the names and addresses of its members. And I have every, that is my duty, and I have every reason to do that.
Mr. Oswald, there are many commentators in the journalistic field in this country that equate the fair play for a Cuba committee with the American Communist Party. What's your feeling about this, and are you a member of the American Communist Party?
Well, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, with its headquarters at 799 Broadway in New York, has been investigated by the Senate subcommittees who are occupied with this sort of thing. They have investigated our organization from the viewpoint of taxes, subversion, allegiance, and in general, where and how and why we exist. They have found absolutely nothing to connect us with the Communist Party of the United States. In regards to your question about whether I myself am a communist, as I said, I do not belong to any other organization.
I noticed from your package that the one...
We've been listening to an interview with Lee Harvey Oswald, which was done in the summer of 1963. On the line is Dr. Philip Melanson, who is a leading expert and author on the subject of the political assassins, an expert on the subject of intelligence in the United States.
The clip you just played is a classic, because he tells the interviewer, creates the same impression that he would create for the FBI when, after his arrest, he asked that an FBI agent be brought into his cell so he could give him a lot of information. And both in that radio interview just played and the FBI interview, he made the Fair Play for Cuba chapter sound like a powerful, clandestine, secretive organization, when in fact it had no members, only a bunch of paper that he generated, and only him, and he never tried to find any other kinds of any other members.
Since I was then in the city and happened to be DA and had the responsibility of seeing what Lee Oswald was doing this summer of 63, I went down to 544 camp to look at it and see what it was. And I took one look and I said, hell, this is a side entrance to Guy Bannister's office. I knew Guy. He used to be head of the Chicago FBI office, and during World War II, he was in the Office of Naval Intelligence.
Lee Harvey Oswald, when he was giving out leaflets supposedly in support of Castro, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, 544 Camp Street was stamped on the literature. So this is where 544 comes into the case, through Oswald having worked there in the same building where Guy Bannister was operating.
But just to underscore the significance of what you just said, what you're describing is a situation which ostensibly communist material has stamped on it an address, 544 Camp, which is the location of part of the intelligence community in New Orleans, meaning, without a question of a doubt, there's prima facie evidence that Lee Oswald was not a communist at all. He was an agent provocateur. We later found out that on the third floor of Bannister's office, he located a small room and cleaned it out and gave it to Oswald to keep his pamphlets in. But you could see Oswald starting out in the morning, and Bannister, with his gruff voice and his those steel blue eyes, saying, "Lee, you're doing a good job. Get some more of those pamphlets out today, son. They like what you're doing in Washington." So he goes out and hands them out like he's a communist, but he's the one that calls the news people to come take the pictures, and he's doing, acting out a role as a communist, but he doesn't know they're really fattening him up to be the turkey for Thanksgiving. He's the scapegoat. They're going to have him murdered by making him look like a communist.
Bannister was once the chief of the FBI office in Chicago. How did he first come to your attention in relationship to the assassination, Guy Bannister?
He first came to my attention, well, before the assassination, when I was district attorney Except Morris and the mayor of New Orleans said we have a man named Bannister. Looks like he might be a good assistant superintendent of police for that vacancy. And I didn't know much about him, but I said if he's got a good FBI background, he certainly is organized and sounds good to me. But anyway, how he first come to my attention was when I, after spending some nights with the Warren Commission, when I had put aside the address 544 camp to check because I saw that Lee Oswald was putting that stamp with his little rubber stamp on papers. He only did it one day and they stopped him. They kind of had a heart attack, I'm sure, but when he was putting that on the papers he was handing out to the public. But he didn't know that he was set to be the scapegoat. So he was doing what he thought was natural. But what actually happened was when he was arrested on August 9th and brought to the first district, first thing he did was to ask to speak to an FBI agent. And the FBI agent came over, Agent Quigley, and very promptly Quigley and Oswald were locked in a private conference for some time.
This is Oswald was arrested?
Yeah, he was arrested on 9th August because of a controversy. It was a setup controversy with other Cubans. In other words, one of those things with another Cuban who at the right time said, Oswald said, hit me, Carlos, and Carlos swung at him and hit him, and then Oswald pleaded guilty. That's just to make it look like he was a troublemaker for the communists. It was all set up. And it was it resolved in those particular pamphlets becoming available to the eye, though, and ultimately available to me. So I put him on side check, and then a few nights later, I came across in the Warren Commission report. I'm surprised nobody else found it first. I found myself reading Colonel Folsom's 201, his personnel file, 201 file of Lee Oswald and the Marines, and he casually mentioned, and here's Lee Oswald's grades in a Rison test. And somebody must have kicked him under the table because he said he didn't do too well. He got almost as many right as he got wrong, but I wouldn't get any right in a Rison test. With all my years in the military, and I was a major by then, I never took a Rison test. He's a private, taking a Rison examination. And so I realized then that there were signs of intelligence before I left the house, and intelligence training of Oswald for some mission. And this was when he took this test, not long before he left for Russia. So obviously, in retrospect, he didn't leave as a communist. He left as a young Marine with an intelligence assignment, because he had, otherwise the Marines wouldn't be teaching him Russian. But I want to see what this sort of place is Russian when this, quote, Russian studying Marine was operating out of, and that's what caused me to go down that weekend morning to Lafayette Square and look at 544 Camp Street, where I found, my God, the so-called communist, the lone assassin, the man who's supposed to have murdered John Kennedy, man who was butchered before anybody could ask him too many questions, was an agent provocateur working for the United States government. That address, 544 Camp, was a side entrance to Guy Bannister's office. Around the corner on Lafayette Street was the entrance to Bannister's office. Across the street, where in the post office building, was an office of naval intelligence, and Bannister was naval intelligence in World War II. I knew some of these people. I knew that. And the Secret Service, as a district attorney in New Orleans, I knew where some of these Secret Service was also across the street. Around the corner in Lafayette, just across Lafayette Square, around the corner, was the office of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And also on another floor, the office of the Central Intelligence Agency. The lone assassin, this person who's been described to all Americans and lied by the federal government to all the world as a communist, was a soldier doing his assignment, a Marine soldier doing what he was taught to do after he was given intelligence training, operating right out of the heart, the very heart of the intelligence community. The reason that the heart is located there so close to the riverfront is that's where all the ships go from New Orleans down to Central America and South America. And a lot of the members of the ship staff, as you might imagine, are intelligence men, too. Nobody was in that office who was not intelligence. Bannister's office. The time that he began operating, the week, is not specific. But it's known that it was through August that he was handing out the pamphlets. And earlier in the summer, he was working around the corner at the Riley Coffee Company. Well, Mr. Riley, not necessarily involved at all, but apparently the nesting place was made available for some requests that the coffee company didn't know the reason for, but requests by the intelligence community for this nesting place for Oswald. He was operating out of the Riley Coffee Company. Didn't have that much to do, so he spent most of his time at the Alba Garage next door, which happened to be the garage, and it's something else I was aware of. That was a garage for the intelligence community. It didn't even accept civilian automobiles. It was filled up with the intelligence community. So that's where he spent the earlier part of the summer, and then when August came, he was handing out the pamphlets as an agent provocateur to look like a communist, so that when Jack Kennedy was murdered by the covert action elements getting ready to kill him for the CIA, so this foreign policy could be changed back to the Cold War policy, he was being trained like a turkey being fattened for Thanksgiving.
That was Guns and Butter's presentation of the 1988 Pacifica Radio documentary, The Assassination of JFK, The Garrison Interview. You can find this full program online at www.gunsandbutter.org and www.dialectradio.co.uk. And we'll have more next week.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now, today, Anissa Miro is with us, and she's in the studio to talk about China's sudden bank struggle, like Britain and America's recent market fall. Hi, Anissa, and welcome to Dialect.
Hello.
Now, is China's economy in danger at the moment?
Supposedly. It seems like it's just a bit of a game of battleships, really, who can survive. They're either lending out too much money or borrowing them, and the daily banks at the moment can't actually afford to help businesses.
Sounds a bit like here, doesn't it? So rumours suggesting that the credit markets are actually freezing up just like here.
Yeah, their credit rates went down parallel to America, which is a bit odd. Bear in mind, sort of China's been the highest and it's always been at the top, so this has been a real shock for everyone.
So you're saying it's kind of paralleling the first days of the UN's financial collapse, but you're also saying that this is, well, it's 5 years or so afterwards. So the same seems to be happening to China now as happening 5 years ago in the US and Britain. What do you think is responsible for all this?
To be honest, I think it's greed, maybe. The fact that when this, well, banks say no, it sort of puts a lot of business companies at a standstill. Everyone's sort of having a moral panic and like freaking out, and because they're in power and they can say no, like, what are we supposed to do and say?
Well, I suppose it's also that they're nervous, aren't they? And that when they're nervous, their natural reaction is just to simply say no, we're not going to take that risk. But what about whether it's deliberate or not, what's going on in China? Is it just an accident that's sort of washed over from the Western world over to China, or is there some kind of deliberate force going on?
Well, the Washington Post did an article recently, and it basically said that it is a bit deliberate. There have been predictions with the growth rate within China, predicted that it's 8.4% to be in 2014. However, it's now gone down to 7.4%, so maybe it's just a plan to obviously hide worse problems that are going on at the moment.
But it's still a lot better than the growth in the Western world. But anyway, are we losing trust with governments?
I don't know. I guess it's up to every person. But I personally think that with them obviously stopping and starting and changing all over, how are we supposed to trust them? Because obviously if it cuts us off with money, and then obviously it affects the rest of us. So bear in mind, China is such a huge, dominant country. Once that stops, then we're all affected.
We certainly are. Hitting the buffers. Anyway, do you see any way through this, Anissa?
Well, I would say honesty, but I doubt we'll get that.
Some honesty. Who do you think's really in charge then, the banks or the governments nowadays?
More so the banks, I would say. I guess they have the more power just because they've got the money. So they obviously can draw up some complaints if they wanted to, just to get people off their backs.
So I mean, the governments have to come with a sort of begging spoon to them, don't they? Anyway, Anissa Mira, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
And I'm joined now by Jason Yannakopoulos. Hi, Jason. You've got a copy of the Bristolian there, the good old The Bristolian, yes. www.thebristolian.net. What's Indeed. The subject matter you're pointing your finger at today?
Well, it looks like there's some wonderful idea to chat with people, or should I mention the Society of Merchant Venturers?
Oh, not them again. This is the old slave traders that still haunt the city, control both of our NHS trusts and a total budget of $1 billion annually of public money. Yes, carry on.
So, let's see. Well, the former chairman of May Gurney was a man known as Tim Ross, who, unsurprisingly, is a merchant venturer.
I mean, we did talk about this last time, didn't we, about the dodgy connections between May Gurney and Jack Lopresti's younger brother, Giovanni Lopresti. This is almost a running sore going on in the Bristolian, isn't it, about the dodgy-looking contract that was signed with May Gurney.
And it's not just that, but just before May Gurney went bottom-up, Mr. Ross managed to cash in his shares. He cashed in 100,000 of his shares to pocket a cool £235,000 just before the company went bankrupt.
Now, isn't that called insider dealing?
Oh, yes.
Isn't that possibly illegal? Anyway, if any of the Avon and Somerset Constabulary are listening, I think we should check into this. Okay, also, of course, Atos has been in the news again this week, Jason. Yes. This is this company, an IT firm, that does the assessments, supposedly, for disabled
people.
They've
been doing it on their own for long, because DWP have found them to be of poor quality and unreliable.
Yes, and our engineer Dave was saying that the BBC also employ Atos to do some of their IT contracts, so it's not surprising that the BBC have been a little bit too easy on them. I know the BBC, talking of which, they also do get quite a lot of EU money, so it's very difficult for them to be quite as critical of the European Union as they might otherwise be.
That is sadly the case. Now, the thing with Atos is that they're of poor quality because... 40% of appeals have been successful, and 86% of those successful on the 15-point scale. Some of these people have been given 6 points or less, and that means they're fully able to work, etc. And in some cases, these have been quite serious. Actually, looking at the story in general, The Guardian actually posed an interesting question that, being as a lot of the tasks are almost made so that people with mental health problems can fail them, if we have such an unreliable system that's failing, and if it's biased against people with mental health disabilities, it does make you wonder why the government is willing to enrol such a massive project nationwide.
Incredible. Jez, do you think whoever takes over from Atos will be any better, Jason?
No.
You didn't even have to think too much about that, did you?
Well, it's a problem within the system rather than a problem within the company that's doing it. I mean, it's actually a problem with the inherent problem is in the way that the assessments are run, the sort of things they're testing, the sort of tests that they do, the sort of things they're looking for.
So how would you like to see it done?
I like to see it done with a little more regards to the people that are doing it, so that it's a real life situation. Bear in mind what the people have been diagnosed with, what their medical record is, and taking these things into account rather than just doing a straight 15-point assessment that could involve things such as, can you transfer from one chair to another? Can you hold your hands above your head?
I hope Ian Duncan Smith's listening, Jason. Anyway, thanks very much for joining us again on Dialect with your little review of the week.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Well, that's all for this week. You can download this weekly podcast from Dialect Radio, one word, .co.uk. Thanks to the studio engineer, Dave Bazanko, Dialect of Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol, 0117 989 7777. 833. You'll find them online at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And also, the number for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline is 01454 318 753. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye.
From a veil, do you think you can tell?